Inbound Eisenhower was very slow today, I'll just have you know.
What's causing that, Wendy?
Construction. I don't like it. Have you ever been on a road where there's no construction?
You know, it's funny you say that because friends of mine just went to Michigan. And I've mentioned this on the show before. And you take that route that gets you from, I mean, it's an obvious route. It gets you from Chicago to Michigan. You go through Indiana.
That's a good route to take.
That's the best
when you're going to Michigan.
There's other ways to get there. But I think if you do the math, you'll find out that it'll take you longer. What you want to do is take a direct route, Chicago, Indiana, Michigan. And they said it took well over 3 hours because of road construction. And I said, and I've said this on the show before, that starting when I was in high school, my friends and I would go to the Warren Dunes in Michigan almost every weekend during the summer, and there was always road construction. And that road construction has been there every summer since. There's not been a single summer that they're not fixing that patch of roadway. I don't know what they're using, pudding instead of tar? Do you use something that'll last more than 10 minutes on your roadway?
Yeah, I don't get it. And we were going to our private beach club this past weekend for our chicken party.
Yeah.
And we took I-55 South, and there's some construction going there. And after we got past the construction horses and things, I said, wow, this is awesome. And mm-hmm. Jimmy Mack goes, for about a year.
Yeah.
And that's what it seems it's like.
It's incredible that they can't find some substance. And I've traveled a lot. I've been to other parts of the country where they'll like repair a road, and then 20 years later they'll repair it again. But here in Chicago, in the Midwest, in Indiana, for some reason they can't figure it out.
Yeah, I don't know. We have this discussion a lot, and nothing ever seems to happen.
I don't know.
Because you're right. In other places where there's bad weather.
Yeah. They're not having the same issues we're having.
Hmm.
How could that be?
Let's figure something out by the end of today.
We'll fix this. This will be fixed. You know Dave Plyer?
Yes, I do, in fact.
Dave Plyer does a show here on WGN Radio, Legal Face-Off.
No, he doesn't do
No?
That.
I thought he was those to Legal
I believe
Face-Off.
His show is called The Dave Plyer Show.
Dave Plyer Show. It's a
silly
Plyer.
Name.
I don't know where they came up with the name. So Dave, yesterday, you were at the
Oh, somebody in traffic is rocking.
And he's got his own music.
What was that?
Okay, that was Adam Chappelle rocking out.
He sounds great.
I don't know what happened.
I don't know what happened either, but I'm going to
I thought
to
it was
see...
an evil takeover.
I'm glad you let it go for a while there.
Do you know how many buttons I pressed? I didn't think for a minute it would be rocking from traffic. Where was he for his report?
I don't know.
Rocking?
I guess he was rocking.
What
Shooting
was that?
Up.
It was beautiful. All right, so Dave Plyer came in yesterday toward the end of our show, and this was all off air, and had tickets to the Cubs game, and I took him up. He said, if you want tickets, I can't go. Something has happened, and I have available tickets, and I can't say no to baseball tickets, so I went to the game, right? So I just have to point this out, because the Cubs have been, well, you saw this in the paper, Wendy, they won the World Series last year.
They
did?
Did
you hear about this? Yeah, it was very exciting. So I went to the baseball game with a friend of mine, and we had a nice time, but I just want to point out one or two quick things. First of all, the Cubs now do a thing. Do you know who Ian Happ is? He's
no.
a new member of the Cubs.
I don't happen to know who it is. Who is he?
I don't understand that. He's a member of the Cubs. Sometimes he plays second base, sometimes he plays third base, sometimes he plays the outfield.
Wow.
They just spin him around, and then wherever he ends up, they just let him play there. And he doesn't like to smile. He just doesn't like to smile. Like, there's some guys, you look over at him, like Chris Bryant, he's always got a smile
always.
On his face.
Did Happ go to school with Jay Cutler by any chance?
Yes. He took... Jay Cutler offers a course for young athletes where he teaches them how to not smile. It's the way... you go, well, you can't make money not smiling. But Jay Cutler offers a not smiling class, and Ian Happ is a part of that. So he just doesn't... You look at him and you go, oh, I hope he's enjoying himself because he's in the major leagues and he's on the Cubs.
And he plays many positions.
He's all over the diamond. I hope he's enjoying himself, but he doesn't seem to be. Except he started doing a thing a couple weeks ago that's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. After a member of the Cubs hits a home run, he somehow got access to a fake microphone. He's got a microphone. It's not hooked up to anything.
Like a Mr. Microphone? Like a big plastic one that you'd see at a...
It looks like a legitimate, like a network microphone, like if ESPN had sent a guy down into the dugout.
Okay.
So he has one, and it's just the microphone, and then it just there's a cord, but it's not hooked up to anything. And then after a guy on the Cubs hits a home run, Ian Happ comes up to him with his microphone, and he interviews him for 30 seconds.
I saw that last night.
It's hysterical.
Dave Bennett wants to jump in on this.
Oh, well, all right, Dave. I think it is a real microphone.
Just no cord.
It's not hooked up, though.
No, it's not. It's just a microphone without a cord. It's not a wireless mic. But apparently he just found it like in a video room.
Right.
And so he decided that he would do this, and so... he does, and Tommy La Stella also has been doing it.
He'll do it too.
How fun is that?
It's the funniest thing because no one can hear it except the interviewer, Ian Happ, or Tommy La Stella, and whoever just hit the home run, but everybody else can see it, you know? So we can all watch it, and it's ridiculous because you're not fooling anybody. It's not hooked up.
Somebody has to figure out a way to switch and put a wireless mic in there that'll be played over the PA.
I'd love that.
While the interview is going. Of course,
he would not.
Well, you know, you don't know exactly what sort of language might find its way through.
Maybe.
But mostly English.
Yeah, but that, you know what?
Salty English.
That's kind of how Bill Veeck got Harry Carey started singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
It is.
He snuck a microphone into the TV booth.
Seriously?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
At Comiskey.
That's exactly right.
And then look what happened with that.
That's exactly right.
I didn't know that, Dave.
All right, so the Cubs have this going on. Whenever the Cubs hit a home run, last night it was Ben Zobrist. He hits a towering home run. And then in the dugout, Ben Zobrist, and then Ian Happ comes up to him and he asks him what I'm guessing was like, what sort of a pitch was it? Or did you know it was gone as soon as you hit it? That kind of a question. And they do this little fake interview. So that goes on. And then also, the Cubs bullpen does this thing now. They've been doing this for a couple of weeks or months.
Right, yeah, most of the season.
Most of the season. So all the relief pitchers do a crazy dance, and the camera cuts in, and they show them doing funny dances. You know how, like, on Peanuts, like during the Christmas special, there's that scene where everybody's doing their own dance?
Right.
While Schroeder is playing the piano?
Yeah. So it's that, but it's Pedro Strop, and it's Carl Edwards. It's the bullpen all doing their own crazy dances. And
can I tell you that's why they're winning? Because they're having fun.
I think that plays into it.
Seriously.
I do think that plays into it. But last night I noticed, and I knew this was going to happen, a couple of members of the Pittsburgh Pirates kind of sneering at this.
They're pirates.
Right. Pirates sneer by nature.
Yeah.
It's just part of being a pirate is you're going to sneer. But I looked over at a couple of members of the Pirates, and they're just kind of not quite at seething level, but they're just kind of, okay, that's not funny anymore.
Right.
Well, when they had the game a few weeks ago with the multiple rain delays, where the game started at, well, it was supposed to start at 1:20, and it got delayed and delayed, and finally ended up ending around 8 o'clock, the 9-inning game that went on and on. Remember that one?
I do.
And that was the game in which the Cubs had brought in, I think Hector Rondon got them. They were like horse heads that he brought in, these masks that the players all put on.
Oh, and I saw somebody had a donkey head.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah,
that's the same one. Right.
That was it.
And these guys playing baseball? I know it was a rain delay, but
Dave,
still.
Was that the same game or was it a different game with the two bullpens? We're vying like
that was the Arizona Diamondbacks.
That was the Diamondbacks.
That was that so was funny.
That,
yeah,
that
yeah.
was that Thursday game. And so the Diamondbacks were doing these, like one of the pitchers was like standing on his hands and just costumes and coming up with weird dances.
Does Stephanie Menendez run the clubhouse over there?
One of our bosses
during
does,
one
yes.
of them, right? The guy pretended he was fishing, and then he reeled in a player from outside the camera.
Yeah, the old fishing move. Yeah.
I want to see more teams like that. I want my White Sox to be like that.
It's really fun to watch.
And it's fun for them.
Right.
Seriously,
think it
takes all the pressure off. I know part of baseball is a mental game.
Yeah.
And if you can just be loosey-goosey, aren't you going to do better?
Yeah, but I think so.
I think if everybody starts doing it, it's going to lose. And there's something a little refreshing about it and kind of new. And all of a sudden, if it spreads like wildfire across baseball,
right.
I think it'll lose that sense of newness.
But, Dave, what about for a while in the NFL, they had this thing where you couldn't celebrate too much.
Right.
The dance afterwards,
yeah.
They'd fine you?
Yeah. So will baseball adopt a similar policy where they go, we can't have fun?
If they wear the horse head on the field, maybe.
I don't think so. And, you know, even football has relaxed those rules this year a bit.
Yeah.
I mean, it got a little ridiculous. Remember Joe Horn, I think it was, the receiver for the Saints, hit a cell phone in the padding on the goalpost and pulled it out after scoring a touchdown. I mean, that kind of thing, I think, is what the NFL has tried to legislate out. But
is that in the interest of time? But why would they stop that? Because if you're a fan, you're loving it. Are they saying, no, it takes up too much time? Or why would they want to stop something like that?
I don't know. I think it's they just thought it somehow showed a disrespect for the game. I'm with you. I mean, I think it's funny. It's entertaining. If guys want to be clever and they're having a good time, it's good for the fans. It's good for the players. It's good for it's good a win-win. Yeah.
And there are some guys, like the White Sox got this pitcher a couple of weeks ago, Justin Wilson.
Yes.
Who is not doing well as a pitcher, but boy, can he dance. Like every time there's a home run, I look for Justin Wilson and I go, this guy can dance.
That no question. I mean, he's been welcomed with open arms by his mates in the bullpen.
Yeah, because of his dancing prowess.
And maybe he'll be on Dancing with the Stars soon.
Wouldn't that be something?
Really, don't you think before Theo and Jed go out and bring in a new relief pitcher, that they give him an audition?
Let's see your moves.
Yeah.
What have you got?
Show us what you got.
Well, Carl Edwards Jr. yesterday after the home run was, I'm not making this up, this sounds like something I would say and it's fake, he was doing the Charleston. He was.
With a horse head on?
He did not have a horse head on. But you know that part of the Charleston where you have your hands on your knees and you flip them like a person going one way? Mm-hmm. So he's doing that. And I go, how does he even know what the Charleston is? But he's doing it beautifully.
Well, he was born in 1991.
Right.
And the Charleston was very big in 91.
For a little while it was. Yeah.
That was our prom theme, the Charleston, at my old high school.
I think he's from Charleston, South Carolina.
Oh, maybe that's it.
So that might explain
it. That makes sense.
How fun is that?
And loved it.
Thanks to Dave Plyer, whom you can hear on this very radio station Saturday into Sunday morning, 2 to 5 a.m.
On the road show, right?
No, it's Dane.
Dane Neal's on that
and
show.
And Dane Neal will be on later.
Yeah.
To punch
you. We'll figure it out. All right. You'd have to wait in line. Thanks, Dave. We'll take a quick break and then a lot more show. It's
Dave's
Bill and
not
Wendy
here.
At WGN.
All right. I'm getting thrown under the bus here for not knowing any White Sox players, which I got to be honest with you. I don't know that many right now. Bill
says there's
been
a huge turnover on the White Sox roster the last couple months. So that even the most ardent of White Sox fans would have a hard time identifying several of the members of the team.
I know Moncada.
Hakuna Moncada.
Bill says White Sox acquired Justin Wilson. Wendy says yes, like she knows that, but Wilson is a Cub.
Yeah, the Cubs acquired Justin
Wilson. Oh, you said
White
Sox.
Did I say the White Sox? No, the Cubs got him.
I didn't hear you say that.
Sorry.
Wendy, can you ask Bill a personal question?
Nope.
When she doesn't need him, does Bill's wife keep him warming up in the Bill pen?
We can edit that out. Right? We'll edit that part out.
Touchdown dance was considered taunting. That's why they kind of took it
out. You know
what?
It was. For some reason, people around the
NFL. Of course it's taunting. They just got a point or six.
Well, but the Pittsburgh Pirates can sneer when they're dancing in the bullpen, but the Green Bay Packers can pop a bear right after they taunt.
Right.
So maybe it was some of that, too.
I do remember them saying that members of the team that did not score the touchdown, you know, felt like they were being taunted, but that was part of it. You know, that's part of the thing. You're doing that little celebration dance. You're kind of getting in their face a little bit.
It's do that every time, you know, one of us has a good line.
Right. So about...
You're dancing more than I am, of course.
Sometimes. Sometimes.
Nice moves, by the way.
Oh, you're very kind. I study under Denny Terrio. Denny Terrio taught me these moves. So, it was an enjoyable evening. I recommend baseball. It's America's pastime.
I'm glad you got to go, because when the tickets were offered to you, it's funny to watch your reaction, because Steve Bertrand and I kind of do the same thing, because it's hard to commit to something.
Yeah.
I won't speak for you, Bertrand, but I know sometimes I don't feel like doing it, but I have fun when I'm there.
Yeah.
But you were like, oh, there's a couple of things I have to move around, which buys you some time.
Well,
I don't know if you really had things to move around.
I legitimately did.
Dinner?
I had, well, I had. I was going to play tennis with some friends,
oh, okay.
So I had to
What's
make
weird
sure that...
is I didn't know the story, but I was in the room with Plyer at the time, and he didn't extend.
Oh.
Like, he might have given you one and me one.
These were seats that were for shorter people, Steve. You would not have fit in these seats. We were right by, you know, the ledge, that overhang ledge?
Yeah.
You would not have fit in
Actually,
seats.
I hang my legs over. I fit right in. Now, I'm going tonight.
You are?
Yeah.
Oh, that'll be fun. That'll be a lot of fun. I went with a friend of mine, Dan, and as we're getting off the train and approaching Wrigley...
Because there's nowhere to park, so you were smart to take
right,
the train.
We saved $500. So there's these guys. There's a lot of jockeying of people who have a couple extra tickets to sell and people who need tickets, and it has to be done under a little bit of a shroud of secrecy because, you know, there's policemen nearby. And sometimes they'll press you a little bit if you're trying to buy or sell tickets, you know, because it is illegal, you know.
What if you just had an extra one?
Right. Well, yeah. So, well, you have to kind of do it that way, you know. You have to word it in such a way as though you're giving somebody a ticket and, oh, look, they're giving you a little cash prize, you know. You have to be very clever about it. So a guy asked us if we had any extra tickets, and as it turned out, we did have an extra ticket. And he offered us, he goes, come here. And we get
you
a little closer,
them?
But not a lot closer. And then he showed us a World Series ring, which he insisted was a legitimate World Series ring.
I bet it was.
Right. I'm sure one of the members of the Cubs gave him this as a gift, and he wanted to, you know, trade the ticket for the ring. And I just wondered, I mean, there are things I'm naive about. But would anybody in the world think that that was a real... I mean, when the World
no.
Series rings came out, they came out with a couple different branches of facsimile rings, and this was obviously one of them. You could look at it and within a half a second know that it was not a real World Series ring, but his eyes got real big, like, how about look at this? Well, look what I have.
No one, I think people might have traded for it because it's cool to have. No one believed for a minute there were real diamonds in
it.
He
said it was a World Series. He goes, this is a real World Series ring. And we go, a real one?
Then why would he trade it for two tickets?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
It's the Pirates.
Right. In keeping with the pirate theme, Steve, there was a lot of pirate activity going on.
Did he have it in a sack?
I think he did.
All right.
How did you know that? I think he did because he was a
pirate.
Pirates
around.
Yeah, that's why. Yep.
All right. Well, Steve, are you really going tonight? You've made a commitment to go?
Yeah.
All right.
No, I know what you're saying. I am pretty bad about that sometimes. I'm trying to figure out the reasons why I couldn't go before I figure out how I can.
I know. I don't commit to anything. And I watch Bill frequently when people come in, old friends or guests or both.
Yeah.
And they say, hey, let's get together. And you pull your, you're the only one I know
I
who still has
book.
A date book.
I do have a date book.
And he pulls it out
phone.
And says, what time, what date? And he's ready to write it down.
Yes.
And a lot of times the people will go, oh, well, what? I'll get back to you. And
I made that mistake once with Bill where he said, you know, we should get together for dinner. And I said, yeah, that'd be great. And to me, that's when it ends.
Yeah, that's you and I have made a lot of dinner dates that way, Steve. And that never happens.
Like, so... But then it never comes to fruition.
The thought is there.
Oh, all right.
You don't really want to go to dinner with them, do you?
I did. And I do have to say, and this is not the difference between White Sox fans and Cubs fans, because there's always various circumstances. But yesterday, in the bottom of the ninth, with two outs, I looked around, and there were still no empty seats. Like
I know.
You mentioned when you went to the White Sox game last weekend, you filtered out, other people filtered
well,
out.
Well, I got to tell you the truth. When I got there, there were a lot of empty seats.
Yeah.
So that's the difference between Wrigley and Sox Park.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. You still want to bring it up a week later that I left early?
I would not bring it up, no.
I will never get the Permaseal seats again.
What inning?
Mid-seventh.
What made you decide in the mid-seventh?
I ate too much at the buffet. I was tired.
You're like
I couldn't
John
have
Panette.
That's what I felt like. And I just, this blackened chicken salad I couldn't stop with. And then I'm like, I'm too full to have a beer. I, you know, the kids, it's their first week of school. I got to get home and make sure they go to bed and do their homework. I just became overwhelmed with my other tasks. I couldn't even live in the moment. It's hard for me to relax, as you know.
I do. I know that. But I don't know that anyone's ever left a game because they were full. That's like the first time I've ever heard of that.
Well, that's
this
what,
game must right. end. I'm full.
I gotta
it's not like
tell
you,
you
had to leave to beat the traffic.
No. I know. And Jim wanted to stay, but then he's, you know, sitting there ready to go into nap mode. We haven't been to a buffet in a long time, and we're out of practice. We overdid it. We're old. We used to drink too much. Now we eat too much.
So before the next game, just hit the old country a couple times before.
No, so I'm not doing the buffet.
Know how to pace yourself.
No, I'm old. What can I say?
Come on. All right, let's do this. We'll take a quick break. News is next. And then, Wendy, the Midnight Circus is here.
Can't wait to find out about it.
We'll find out about the Midnight Circus. It's coming up in just a little bit. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. This is just a practice show, Wendy.
Wow.
This is not
ever
a real
since
show.
We took control
show.
Here.
I know.
This morning, we should demand a redo.
Yeah.
Something that we want to talk to you about that I have to admit I've heard a lot about. It's in its 11th year. It's the Midnight Circus in the Parks tour. Yet I've never gone, and so we have the founder and ringleader.
It's not a real show. On a normal day, I worry.
Ringleader. Of the Midnight Circus, Jeff Jenkins in the studio. Jeff, how are you?
I am good. Thanks for having me.
Is any of what Wendy just said true?
Some of it is true. I am the founder and the ringmaster, although me and my wife founded it together.
Oh.
How does
Chicago.
This happen?
And she's certainly the artistic genius behind it. I can help put up the tent. That's my skill.
All right. Well, that's a pretty good skill to have, first and foremost.
Yes.
Were you a circus guy in your youth?
Well, I grew up here in Chicago, in the Chicagoland area, and then I took off and joined Ringling Brothers when I was 18.
Wait, you're the kid who says, I'm running away to join the circus and did it?
I am that kid.
Do me a favor, because that's always, like, we think a myth, but you're mm-hmm. proof that it really does happen. What happened in that moment where you said, enough of this, I'm leaving everything I have, and I'm going to travel with a circus? What were you
thinking? I was bitten by the bug in fourth grade. I remember distinctly, I was bitten by the bug in fourth grade. I went to see Ringling Brothers in the old stadium.
Yeah.
And I snuck backstage, and one of the clowns caught me back there. And rather than chucking me out, he brought me back into Clown Alley, which back then was very different. It was kind of like Willy Wonka meets the Wizard of Oz meets, you know.
Oh, my God.
It was really magical and interesting. And then...
Most kids would have been scared in fourth grade going into Clown Alley, I just want to say.
It was magical, I'll tell you that.
Really?
And then, you know, fast forward, you know, this guy had a huge influence on me, bringing me back there. And then fast forward, you know, 20 years later, I graduated from Ringling Brothers Clown College, mm-hmm. touring with the circus, and they bring me back to teach. And our graduation show for the new students, and some guy tries to sneak backstage, and I catch him. It's Sean Emery, the clown, who caught me.
Oh.
Fast forward again, his daughter, Ariel Emery, graduates from the National Circus School in Canada and is now a member of the Midnight Circus. Spectacular acrobat.
This is all coming full circle, isn't it?
It is coming full circle, but that's what it's about, and that's what the program is about.
All right, so tell us about the Midnight Circus in the Parks tour. It's been going on for 11 years. You perform in areas where there isn't usually a circus. Is that correct?
We do. We perform all over Chicago, but we've made a real point, and with the support of certainly the community and the Chicago Park District, the mm-hmm. Night Out in the Parks Initiative. We start the tour at 103rd and Cottage Grove at Gately Park last weekend. This week one will be at Hamilton Park in Inglewood. Then we just keep marching forward from there. So we go from the very south of Chicago all the way north and all points in between.
What do you make of, in the last couple of years, the proliferation of circuses, circuses?
Mm-hmm.
The number of circuses in and around the United States has dwindled dramatically.
I'm very obviously with Ringling closing,
yeah.
Big Apple, and although hopefully they're coming back. You know, it's challenging. Circus is hard work.
Sure.
I'll tell you first and it's incredibly hard because you're building that theater. Every day.
Yeah.
You know, when we go out to do the show, we have to build the tent, and sometimes it's raining. So it's difficult. You know, the odds are against you. So it's understandable.
So what can we expect at your circus?
Oh, boy, I'll tell you. We are fortunate in that we attract spectacular performers, really from all over the world,
mm-hmm.
new theatrical, contemporary-style performers. We put them in a one-ring, intimate magical purple and blue big top where you're sitting there watching the show and you are practically in the ring with them. The show is really spectacular. That's why we play to 15,000 folks a year. That's why we're the only American circus company invited to the Montreal Circus Festival. That's like headlining Lollapalooza
for
Chicagoans.
That's very impressive.
That's how good the show is. That's how good
animals
the show
or
is.
No animals?
There are no animals
yeah.
save for two rescued pit bulls, Rosie Ray and Junebug, who are my personal pets and always steal the show. They're at home on the couch with my daughter, Samantha, who's in the show.
Oh, yeah?
Yes, she's in the show.
How old is she?
She is 10. And then my son, Maxwell Jenkins, he's 12. We got three fantastic Chicago public school kids in the show. One of them is the daughter of an incredible former Russian acrobat.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, a couple dozen performers from all over the globe. I guarantee you, you've seen nothing like it in your local park.
And where's the schedule? Where can we find out where it's playing next?
MidnightCircus.net has the schedule.
You mentioned your son. He's making a name for himself in Hollywood, isn't he?
He is.
Talk
is that
about
all
the
you
role.
Want to get
Are
into?
Are you allowed to say the role he just got? Because we're impressed to meet you, but when we heard about this, what your son is going through, yeah. Wendy and I and Kevin all said, we must talk about this.
It's funny because the last time we were down here, he was filming right here at this building.
At Tribune Tower?
He's doing a scene that incorporated the building and the history of the building with the rocks. And all stuck in the wall. A Family Guy with Gerard Butler and Willem Dafoe, and he was Gerard Butler's son. So I remember being down here. It was a very kind of poignant, touching scene.
It was about this time last year, right?
It was, yeah. Exactly.
I remember
exactly.
when they were out there filming. Yeah. But is he not playing? He's recreating a role from TV past, right?
He is. Netflix is relaunching Lost in Space in a spectacular Netflix way.
And he'll be Will Robinson.
He is Danger Will Robinson.
Good
Billy
God.
Moomin, who played the role
Billy
originally.
Billy Moomin,
he's
who
the
is...
new...
been a dear friend and a great influence on Max. They spent the last year together as
really?
He was
Bill is
it.
So jealous right
I'm
now.
I'm so jealous.
Billy Moomin, he is, first of all, A-list actor, spectacular actor.
Yeah.
But talk about an A-list guy. Him and Max shared so their love of music. He helped him craft this beautiful song. My son plays mandolin. Billy Moomin is, of course, a very accomplished musician.
Yeah.
So he helped him, doing his homework, craft this fantastic song about Pete Seeger, who's a hero of both of them, for his homework project at Coonley Elementary, where he's a Chicago public school kid. I want to give a huge shout out to my public school.
That's awesome.
Here.
So did your son have an awareness of the original Lost in Space before he got cast? Did he see old episodes of it?
We showed him some. He laughed.
That's what you do.
It was great. It was great back then. The new one is going to be really something.
That's so
exciting.
We
haven't seen much of it. They filmed the first season, but it's under wraps. But it's going to be spectacular.
Wow.
Congratulations on
that. But you can
that.
See him in the circus, too. You think he's good in Lost in Space, you want
to
see him in Midnight
Even better
Circus.
Than Midnight
so
circus.
Your daughter and your son both perform in this in the Midnight Circus.
They do. Also, Regina Mermanoff, who's a spectacular young acrobat. Yeah, well, it's a family affair. It really
I can
is.
Juggle.
My wife is up. You're hired. The hours are long. The pay is lousy.
Okay, forget it.
Jeff, you, as a boy, ran away and joined the circus. What if one of your kids said, I want to run away and be an accountant? How would you handle that?
Jeff would give him a ride. You'd
Maybe.
Be supportive.
Happily.
Would you?
But, like most parents, whatever your kids want to do, as long as it's remotely legal, you're going to support them.
Let them do it. Yeah, be happy.
Absolutely.
All right. So all fun and games, the Midnight Circus in the Parks tour. You can go to midnightcircus.net to find out more. Mm-hmm. But aside from it being a great show, you are giving back to the neighborhoods. Talk about how much money
you've
raised so far.
From the very beginning, the whole idea, it started in our local park, Wells Park. Our park supervisor and our alderman at the time took a risk and said, yeah, let's do it. Open air, no tent at the time. Let's do a weekend of shows. And then the funds will go help rebuild the playground. Well, it was over $20,000, I believe, we pulled in that weekend. And we said, we're on to something. People want to see great live entertainment, world-class stuff in their neighborhood park.
Mm-hmm.
And they're willing to pay for it, even though the tickets, they're a steal. But that money goes right back to your neighborhood park. And so to date, we're at about nearly $1 million raised.
Good Lord.
And we couldn't do it without, of course, the park advisory councils, those selfless volunteers who give so much to their neighborhood parks and the support of the park district. But it's all about bringing folks together in their community, empowering them to make a difference in their community, in their park.
Think about it, though. If all of a sudden the traveling circus show came to your block, you wouldn't go to it?
You'd have to go.
I mean, it would be awesome.
Well, that's why we sell out every show, because people can literally walk across the street to your neighborhood park and for a very small fee see an incredible show. And knowing that most of the ticket sales and the concessions and the ad book go right back to your park. And your neighbors are there. You're bumping elbows. You're meeting folks you didn't meet who happen to live right across from you. And all of a sudden, you have this community that you didn't know you had.
And there's peanuts.
There is peanuts.
All right.
And popcorn.
Popcorn.
A lot of popcorn.
Good too.
Some cotton candy on a good day.
We learn the hard way. Don't do cotton candy. Bees like cotton candy.
Oh, right.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
We have, I won't speak for you on this,
all right.
But I know it's true. I'm a little afraid of clowns. What is our problem?
Well, you know, our clowns are not traditional clowns in that sense. I mean, I'm the ringmaster and also a very eccentric clown character in the show. Mm-hmm. And I wear about as much makeup in the ring as I have on now. So it's very human in that way. You
For
wouldn't
people
come to
can't
our
see
show.
Jeff, you're wearing yeah. no makeup right
well,
now.
Well, yeah, there's
a little bit of blush, touch, but you look
know.
Adorable.
But what self-respecting father wouldn't leave home without a little bit of blush?
You need it on a day like today.
But it's really accessible in that way. It isn't over the top. And gaudy.
Is that why we're afraid of clowns? Because of the makeup, they depict something like always a smile, yet we don't know what the inner feelings are?
It can be scary, certainly. I'll tell you, coming from Ringling, where some of the clowns, where you do these over-the-top makeups, it can be a little intimidating, but ours, certainly not.
The All remake right, of It is coming out in a couple weeks. Is that good for business or bad for business?
I never really thought about that. Look, if Stephen King would buy a ticket and tweet about the show, I think it'd be great for business.
It would be, wouldn't it?
All right, we have to take a quick break. Jeff Jenkins, founder and ringleader of Midnight Circus. It's the Midnight Circus in the Parks tour. It returns to what's become an annual Chicago family tradition. This is the 11th year, and you can get all the deets at midnightcircus.net. It's Bill and Wendy, 720 WGN. We're talking Midnight Circus, internationally known Midnight Circus in the Parks tour. It returns to maybe your neighborhood for the 11th year. You can go to midnightcircus.net, and the founder and ringleader of Midnight Circus, Jeff Jenkins, in the studio with us. Someone has called and said that they are an old friend of yours, Jeff.
Yes.
Bob?
I got a couple friends. Bob. Yes, I remember Bob Weber. Yeah.
Bob, are you there?
Yes. Hi, Jeff. How are you?
I'm good. Nice to hear from you. It's been a few years.
Oh, it has. And I'm just tickled that you're very successful. And I just love hearing your voice. And I just feel your energy over the phone. It sounds like you got a great thing going. And I'm very thankful that you're moving forward. And sounds like a great show. We did see you at Metropolis 1 year.
Yes, back in the day. We did some theatrical productions back in
at
the
Metropolis.
Day. Yeah, yeah. Northlight Theater, Metropolis, Ivanhoe. We did a lot of very theatrical stuff before we decided that, you know, if we're going to really make a difference and bring circus to folks who don't always get it, we got to bring it to the people.
Yeah.
And that's the local parks. And so we shifted focus, mm-hmm. and we created this program that brings it to the neighborhood, bringing circus to
Great
the people,
idea.
As we say.
I love it. Bob, thank you for calling. We appreciate it.
Mike, good luck to you, and thanks for taking my call. Bill and Wendy, I love you guys.
Oh, thank you so much.
Take care, Bob.
Thanks, Bob. Somebody has texted us and wanted to know if this Midnight Circus comes to the suburbs at all.
You know, we don't right now. The focus of the program is Chicago. We've partnered with, you know, the Chicago Park District, the mayor's office through the Night Out and the Parks Initiative. And some other terrific sponsors. So we really focus on Chicago. Our bandwidth is kind of lean right now. It's a mom and pop shop.
Mm-hmm.
So we go where we can right now, and that's to our neighborhoods all across our great city.
A couple of weeks ago, my wife and I went to Wisconsin, and part of our tour included Baraboo, where the Circus Hall of Fame is.
Spent years there.
And the one thing that stood out to me the most was the incredible artwork on circus posters, mainly from the 1930s and 1940s. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh,
it just had such an incredible look to it.
Yeah, they hired, you know, first-class artists back in the day to create those posters. Because there wasn't social media.
Yeah.
You know, you saw a poster and you went, oh, the circus is in town. And literally the town would shut down.
Yeah.
And everyone went to the circus. And that's what we're trying to do on the weekends in Chicago. You know, our volunteers, they get those banners and those posters up. And we hope that, you know, for a couple hours, everyone takes a break, heads to their neighborhood park and takes in the circus.
And gets a little escape from what's going on in the real world.
Amen.
That's what we all need.
Amen.
What
yes,
do you make
indeed.
Of, there was a time where part of a circus, almost every circus, included a freak show. I mean, that doesn't happen anymore.
You volunteering?
I have a resume I brought in.
That would be
looking for everybody.
Well, that would be me, the middle-aged acrobat, right?
But that was commonplace for a long time, is people with various oddities were paraded out, and, you know,
that's how they made their money, unfortunately.
There were some circuses who did that.
Yeah.
You know, certainly it's something that doesn't happen anymore, thankfully.
Yeah.
We've gotten more sensitive, more aware as a society.
Yeah.
You know, I think same thing with the animal issue. We've expanded right. our mind a bit.
And here in Chicago, if we want a freak show, we just look at politics. That's all we need.
You know, it's right there.
Yeah.
I'm sad on both sides of the whole animal issue. I know that circuses who had animals really took care of them because that was their bread and butter. I know there were some people that did not treat their animals so well. I'm relieved that they're kind of out of the picture right now.
You know, I think that's a whole nother radio show. You know, I saw some really healthy, productive animal-human relationships. And I'll be honest, I saw some that weren't. My two performing pit bulls are very much family pets. Mm-hmm. Everything they do in the ring, they do in the park with me every morning. So when you come out and see them, you go, well, that's a natural fit. Mm-hmm. They're on the couch right now listening to the show with my daughter. So they got it good.
Do they listen to us regularly, Jeff? I'm curious.
Rosie Ray, particularly, the younger one, is a huge fan of yours.
Oh, that's very nice to hear.
Hi, Rosie Ray.
That's very nice
to see you.
When you did your tour at the age of 18, first of all, did family members try to talk you out of this? And second of all, was it what you thought it would be? Because there's a romanticism to traveling around the country on a train. Mm-hmm. You know? Was it what you thought it would be?
My family was incredibly supportive. Because I was kind of unwavering from fourth grade till I, you know, eked out graduation that I wanted to do this. Mm-hmm. And it was everything and more.
Really?
Everything. It was a spectacular lifestyle for a Chicago kid to, you know, plop on this train and travel all over the country with these incredibly talented, exotic, diverse people from literally all over the globe. China and Russia and South Africa. It was amazing.
Circus exists. I mean, we always think of the American circus, but there's a version of it almost anywhere in the world, isn't there?
Oh, there certainly is. Yeah? I mean, Cirque du Soleil has done some spectacular things. You know, Seven Fingers out of Montreal, we're huge fans and you know, collaborators in one sense. We work with a lot of the same folks. There's a lot of great circus happening.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, changed and evolved.
Yeah.
When did you start traveling with the circus? Not in fourth grade. You went to school,
18,
right?
Oh, I went to school. Oh, okay. Yeah, 18, right after high school.
Because I'm like, your parents let you go? I mean, I know it's a great world experience, but wow.
No, I graduated barely, but I eked out. That's a rule with my kids. As long, you know, as soon as you graduate from your neighborhood public high school in Chicago, then you can do whatever you want to do.
But that storyline, like your storyline, whenever it's told in book form, in novel form, or in a movie, it's darkly mysterious. Like you've seen Something Wicked This Way Comes. It's a similar story. It always has a dark twist to it. Your story doesn't have a dark twist, does it?
Not
for air.
There's a few skeletons in the closet, I'm sure, but probably won't bring those out on GN at 10:30 a.m.
I'm just loving that your son, Max, is he 11?
He's 12.
12 years old. He knows how to play the mandolin and is into Pete Seeger, which means he loves folk music. I have an 18-year-old who's into folk music. We should hook them up. They can start a little band.
He does have a band, actually. He plays out. They came together at the Old Town School of Folk Music.
Yeah.
And they play a lot around town. They play at a lot of street fairs and festivals. Cowboy Jesus and the Sugar Bums. They're pretty
cool. Oh, my God.
Great name.
Yeah, pretty good. I wanted to name him as a kid, but that didn't work.
Cowboy Jesus? Yeah. Is that going to be his name?
Did not fly. We used it for the band. But he's a huge Seeger fan. You know, that comes from all our days of marching with our teachers. Yeah. But that's a whole nother point.
Yeah. Boy, we have to have you on once a week to tell a different story.
Yeah.
It is a pleasure to meet you, Jeff Jenkins, the founder and ringleader of Midnight Circus. It's a great thing that you're doing. Are you surprised 11 years later it's still going strong?
I am surprised, but most of all, I'm grateful. I'm grateful to the audiences, the communities, and the volunteers, because I think it's an important program.
Mm-hmm. Keep us posted as to when Midnight Circus comes to the suburbs, because we all want to see you.
You bet.
Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That is Jeff Jenkins. We'll take a quick break. We've got news next and then a whole lot more coming your way after that. It's Bill F. and Wendy Snyder on WGN.
Thank you, Steve. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. And Dane Neal is on the air with us. And I happen to be listening to your On the Road show on Saturday. It was, I think, 3 o'clock, which is right in the middle of your 2 to 4 p.m. window.
Yes.
I enjoyed you.
You got a window and there was the middle of it and you're right in the center. Mm-hmm. That would have been right. That's called the sweet spot of the of the program.
Yep.
Well, thanks, Wendy. You know, I appreciate you listening. Sometimes you know how it is. You know, sometimes you understand that people are listening, but you're not necessarily thinking about what individuals might, unless it's, you know, your grandmother's texted you or your mom said.
It was me. Yeah, I texted you. You enjoyed your Lou Ferrigno interview and your Michael Rooker interview.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Michael Rooker was a lot of fun. You guys have him in all the time, and it was really, really cool to be able to sit down. And it doesn't happen all the time. I mean, like in this, you get to interview notable people on a regular basis that mean things to certain people. But for me to interview him was really, really cool.
Oh, good. Very, very good. Another Lou joins us today. You are now doing your one Lou per week thing.
Well,
and today's Lou is who?
We've got, yeah. We're obligated to maintain a certain level of Lou. Mm-hmm. And we're going to keep that going here and excited to have him in. You think about some of the trends that happen in the food scene, spirit scene, you know, where something comes onto the horizon, may have been around for a long time, but it reaches a level of prominence that people are like, wow, this is great. Then everybody gets into it, enjoys it kind of at a mass level. And mezcal is one of those that I'm not sure if it's, you know, quite at the whole level of Limarita Bill, mm-hmm. you know, yet, but it's the mm-hmm. kind of thing where most people have heard of it. Most people have maybe know what it is or think they do as kind of the, you know, the extra step cousin of tequila. But there is so much more to it. It is one of the more unique and nuanced spirits with a tremendous backstory and history. And so I thought it would be great to have the mezcal evangelist in himself, the founder of Sacred Agave, the one and only Lou Bank. And I will say this, he won't say it, but one of the foremost, maybe premier, certainly the one in the area here, experts in the world of mezcal. Lou,
how are you?
Hi, Lou.
I am well. And just to go back to what you were saying earlier, I think you'd actually like me when I'm angry. So
unlike Lou Ferrigno,
exactly.
Who you do not like when he's angry.
No, you do not.
Can I tell you something that might be the wrong thing to say? We haven't rehearsed this in any way, shape, or form, but when I think of mezcal, I think of the worm.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. As Dane was saying that, like, everybody knows it. I would say if we went outside right now, first of all, nobody would be able to hear us. But second of all, we stop 100 people. We stop 100 people walking by this window, right? And I would guess that maybe 20 of them would have heard of mezcal. And of those 20, probably 15 would think exactly what you just said, that it's that stuff with the worm
in it. It's the tequila with the worm at the bottom of the bottle.
Yeah, you know, the places that Dane and I hang out, right, the finer restaurants and food festivals and everything, those people are in on it. This is like, this to them is manna from heaven. But I think the broader audience still doesn't really know about mezcal. And even if you break down, if we go into our bubble, into the food world bubble, the foodie bubble,
bloop,
and start, we are there, and start talking to those folks about mezcal, I think you'd find out pretty quickly that while they talk about it and they love it, they don't really understand it, because you're not wrong. Mezcal, really, if you just look at the numbers, is the stuff with the worm in it.
And I thought that was always kind of like a cheaper, not as quality version of tequila, and that's why the worm was put in it for, more frivolity.
Yeah, you know, like I would say that it's probably marketing that created the whole worm in the bottle thing, but there are hundreds of stories. I don't know which one is true. What I do know is true. What I do know is true is, you know, you've got Bud. Is Bud Light one of your sponsors? I'm going to say Coors. Yeah. You've got Coors, yeah. Right, which is a beer.
Yeah.
But then you've also got you've got Three Floyds, right, in mm-hmm. Munster. It's also beer.
And you can like them both, because I do.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. And there are absolutely cheap mezcals with a worm in it that, you know, honestly, like if you corner me and make me tell you the truth, I kind of like the flavor, but not as much as I like these beautifully made traditional and artisanal agave spirits, many of which actually aren't mezcals because they're not certified as mezcals.
What's the difference between just bare bones? You're an expert at this. For people who are not, though, mezcal and tequila are different in what ways?
Well, okay, so I'm going to make this really difficult to understand for you.
All right,
is that good?
That's
okay.
The best.
So,
thank you.
So mezcal, in theory, is sort of like a category, right? In the same way that whiskey is a category, and underneath whiskey, you can have scotch and you can have bourbon, like that, right? Beer is a category, and underneath beer, you have lagers and ales, and underneath ales, you've got stout, right? So there's like these subcategories. Mm-hmm. So mezcal used to be category. Until the government, the Mexican government, seized ownership of the word. And now you have to be certified to be mezcal, which is really confusing because tequila was a kind of mezcal. Well, now it can't be a kind of mezcal because you have to be certified to be mezcal.
And like the champagne thing has to be from France.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So it gets very confusing. And I hate the Mexican government for that.
Oh.
And now they'll probably never let me back in their country.
They're big listeners. You know that.
They are listening now.
Yeah. That'll be your loss, by the way.
Thank you. Right? Back. Yeah. Yeah.
One of the things that I know that on the tequila side, and we've seen maybe in the last, not really that long, maybe 5 years or so, 7 years, where you've had that tequila kind of blend into a premium spirit where people are taking extra time kind of diversifying. They've always done that, but then making it something that's really, really expensive, like what you're seeing kind of with rum over the last couple of years. You know, everybody's got kind of their turn at the table. I want to hear, and if you could share with the listeners, on the mezcal side, so much of what you appreciate and what people who know appreciate is that traditional process. And when you see some of those photos, this isn't like, hey, I've got a charming copper pot still in the middle of wherever. This stuff looks... It looks ancient, you know. I mean,
yeah, it's like that mosquito that they found in
amber.
And thank you, the mosquito in amber. It's fascinating to me. The first time I went down to Mexico and visited a palenque, basically a distillery that's connected to somebody's home, where they're making traditional and artisanal agave spirits, I was blown away. I started a distillery in Oregon, and everybody who likes to drink has gone to a distillery for a tour. And so I thought I understood what this all looked like. And I walk in this guy's, his factory, and quote unquote factory.
Right.
And it, what I'm seeing looks like a brick oven pizza cooker, right? A brick oven for pizza with a chiminea dropped in the middle. It's the weirdest looking thing I've ever seen. How did this guy come up with this, right? And so a few days later, I'm in Mexico City at a used bookstore, and I find what is in essence like farmer's almanacs from 1849. And I page through the volume where distillation is, and I find the blueprints for this guy still.
Mm.
And like, was it state of the art in 1849? Mm-hmm. Right? So this guy he's not using dials and knobs. He's not using any kind of measurement tools, modern tools, to do what he's doing. He's using his five senses, and he's using wood fire to heat his still. It's unlike anything. It is slow food in a bottle when it's done well.
And it has a smoky taste because of that?
I would actually, like... I could sit you down and taste your stuff, and you would find what you would regard as smoky characteristics in it. But I would argue that what you're tasting is actually roasted sugars, not smoke.
Okay.
Because while there's smoke in the process, it very rarely touches the actual spirit when it is well made.
Got it. There's a difference between roasted and smoked, definitely. I get that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Though both of them are euphemisms for things you shouldn't do.
Right. Well, Lou, thank you
baked
for pointing
as well.
That out.
There you
thank
go.
You for pointing all that out. Yeah. We will discuss this further in just a little bit. Lou Bank is here. Dane Neal is here. And we're here. Bill and Wendy, if you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. We'll get that done. It's WGN.
Dane Neal is here. And we are talking mezcal. Am I saying it right with Lou Bank?
Yes. Mezcal? That's good enough. Everybody knows
mezcal?
Yeah.
What mezcal?
Mezcal.
Mezcal.
All right, what were we were talking, it's under the tequila umbrella, but it's...
No, the opposite.
Right.
But again, like since the Mexican government took possession of the word mezcal from the people, now what I say is agave spirits, and not everybody agrees with me. There's a lot of debate, but it's an agave spirit. They're all made from agave. Mm-hmm. Tequila is made from one agave, blue agave, in a specific region. Mezcal is made also in a specific region. But it's a broader region than the tequila denomination of origin, and it's made from different kinds of agave.
We've got some here.
Is this going to be on the final, by the way?
Yeah.
Yeah, all right.
Yes.
I see Lou like writing on a chalkboard loudly, right. And this is this. And
yeah.
Anyone.
As the education happens here and in restaurants and with chefs here in Chicago, one of the things that is one of the things that he has done, not only just as an ambassador for the spirit, you know, we run into a lot of those people who are fans or working for or on behalf of something. And so he's doing that not only here, but also traveling the world. You think our close proximity to Mexico, you know, we've had just by nature of many spring breaks, mm-hmm. you know, and travels and everything. We've been able to taste certain things like that. He's traveled though to Italy, to London, to Scotland, right? And shared this, as kind of an at par spirit with the ones that they have, and talk a little bit about too how you're trying to educate not only, you know, the world into why it's great and special, but also the people that are making it.
Yeah, yeah. So, in fact, one of the tastings that I did was for the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society, arguably the largest group of spirits collectors in the world, most sophisticated spirits collectors in the world. And after that tasting, I had a number of those members come over to me and say, you know, you could take any of the master distillers out of Scotland, bring them to Mexico to make this stuff, give them a year, and they still wouldn't be making it. Hmm. It's so complex and difficult to make. But you could take any one of these master distillers out of Mexico, bring them to Scotland, and in a couple of months, they'd be making amazing scotches.
Why is that?
It's because they don't use tools. They use their senses. They use their sense of smell, taste, touch, their hearing to determine when things are ready and when they're done. And they do it in a way that nobody else does it anymore. It's absolutely a lost art, except in Mexico, where there are thousands of these amazing, gifted people.
Who
are making these beautiful spirits. So what I am trying to do is get more people to drink the great stuff. Mm-hmm. In fact, I helped to connect a local organization, CH Distillery, who makes great vodkas here, helped connect them to a friend of mine in Oaxaca to start importing some of these uncertified agave spirits that are going to come up here in small batches, 40, 80-liter batches under the name Cinco Sentidos. And it's going to be some of the most beautifully made agave spirits.
Cinco Sentidos.
Yeah, that's Spanish for five senses.
Five Sentidos.
Did
you smell the aroma of this first one that Dane has passed out? Because I have to tell you,
Dane has passed out from the aroma.
I'll admit it. It completely caused me to salivate. Oh. It's like all of a sudden I smelled the aroma, and it's like I couldn't wait to have it.
There you go. Yeah. You know, and this is what I'm finding over and over again as I talk to chefs, talk to bartenders. They are picking up on the nuances of this, and it's like nothing they've experienced before. And that's really where I think the boom is. I think more so than general consumers, it's in these people in the industry, in the food and hospitality industries, that are starting to really get deep into agave spirits.
It's pretty warm. My lips are on fire.
You know what? It's warm and cold at the same time, which I don't understand, but it is. How am I getting it warm and cold?
Are your lips burning?
My lips are not burning, but I can taste it in my throat. There's a hotness and a coolness to it.
There is a way to taste this, a specific way, and I would have stopped you had I thought about it. But so what I like to tell people to do is
using a silly straw. Is that the wrong way to do it?
you've got one of those helmets with the one in each.
Yes. Anyway,
so what you want to do is take three sips, and each of those three sips should be the smallest sips you've
ever
taken of anything.
And my sip was pretty small too.
Three sips.
Does it get you drunk on one taste?
It's entirely possible. This stuff is probably 55% alcohol.
Oh, good golly.
You want to take three tiny sips and leave each sip on your tongue to the count of five before you swallow.
All right, hold on a second.
Wow, it tastes better when you do that.
There you go.
Seriously.
And so what you're doing with that first sip is clearing your palate. The second sip is preparing your palate. The third sip, you're actually tasting it. Now, when I say preparing your palate, what I mean is everything else you've ever had to drink that's alcohol, it all starts from a sugar base.
Sure.
And those sugars from everything else you've ever had to drink all come from something that took a maximum of 6 months to grow.
Yeah.
Grapes, grains, whatever it is, 6 months.
Yeah.
The agave.
That's good on my tongue.
Right? Okay, we're going to have to cut her off.
Right.
The agave takes a minimum of 4 years. And I've got some agave that have taken 40 years to harvest. So your sugars are maturing over 40 years versus 6 months. It's so much more complex.
Is your palate sophisticated enough to where when you taste one, you say, I'm going to say 5 years, 10 years? Can you tell the aging just by the taste of it?
Me? No.
No,
I've got horrible allergies. Some people can. I've got horrible allergies, and I have dogs. I'm allergic to dogs. I live with dogs. I can't taste anything anymore.
Yeah.
But I've got friends who can taste it, and they can't necessarily tell you, this is a 12-year agave.
Yeah.
But they can tell you this is from this region of Mexico. It's made with a clay pot still versus a copper pot still. It is fermented in wood versus fermented in bullhide. Like, they can tell you that stuff. I'm just not that slick.
Different flavors on both of these. Completely different flavors.
Yep. One is Eduardo Angeles, roasted in earth, and one was Tio Rey from Sola de Vega.
Yeah. Yeah. So Eduardo's the guy who pulled me into this. Eduardo Angeles from Santa Catarina Minas is the guy who got me so obsessed with this. So he stopped me one day. He knew that I ran nonprofits here in Chicago, one of which is Storybus. And so it's an education nonprofit. And he asked me, can you help me educate the people in my town? Can you help me build a library? Mm-hmm. So I started bringing this stuff back, raising money and sending that money back down to build libraries in rural Mexico.
And so he's doing that, educating those people, educating the world, and also providing some great events where you can get some of these great flavors and education. So before we let you go, Lou, you've got an event tomorrow, right? You want to give
tomorrow evening, really small event. It's a preview of Mexico in a Bottle. Mexico in a Bottle is an annual festival of mezcal in Chicago. So we're doing a preview dinner at Presidio from 7 to 9 p.m., $150 a ticket. You also get a ticket then to the festival in October. So you can find that online at agavedinner.com. And then I've also got early October the Fermentation Festival up in Reedsburg, Wisconsin. And we're going to have that guy, Eduardo Angeles, here in Wisconsin doing a dinner.
Oh, excellent. Real quick, is it an insult to the mezcal to turn this into a margarita, or is everything okay when you're doing that?
If you do that to my mezcal, I'll break your fingers. But if you
want
to do that with somebody else's,
it's okay.
You know, however somebody can come to the spirit and fall in love with it, as long as they also then taste it neat. Because I want them to move to a space where they're paying $300 a bottle for great stuff so that money can help fund these communities.
Oh, all right.
And so, Lou, social media-wise, where can people follow you?
Go to sacredagave.org. If you want to get a sample of agave spirits, go to agavetriangle.org, donate $25 to Replant Agave, and then the receipt, you can take that to these four different restaurants and bars in Logan Square, and they will each give you a taste of a different
agave
spirit.
And
that's
the receipt
awesome.
Has a worm in it. Isn't that weird? I've never
I'll
seen
eat
that
it.
Before. I don't know how that happened.
Nice to meet you, Lou.
Thanks very much.
Dane, thanks so much. We'll take a quick break. Some news is next. Stick around, Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Thank you, Kim Gordon. It's Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder, and I was watching a lot of video last night of rescue efforts in Texas after Hurricane Harvey. And I have a couple of things that I would like to share with people. One is there was a news guy who was there, and it was raining, not very hard, but raining, and they were going through this neighborhood where houses were flooded up to the second floor. Mm-hmm. You could see the water had gone up almost to the top of their garage door on a connected garage to the house. Mm-hmm. They were going through in this boat. They had showed army trucks that you've seen on the road that are huge that were buried in water. They were completely underwater. You could just see the very top of the roof. And this went for miles and miles. And the reporter there who was talking was describing all the damage and how you can't even imagine to have that much water in your house. And my question is, as they're going around on that raft with a motor, what if there are submerged cars? If there were submerged army vehicles that you could see the roof of, what about a smaller car? Couldn't that boat run into that?
Why not?
Very nervous as I was watching them go along.
Yeah.
If there was a submerged car, all of a sudden the boat would run into it and that would be very bad.
Yeah, I don't know how that works.
There was also this woman, Lisa Livingston Eicher, who a lot of people reshared her post on Facebook. She originally put it up on Instagram. And it's remarkable rescue of, this is what Lisa Livingston Eicher had to say. She said, we have two kids with Down syndrome, a three-legged dog, and a pig, all of whom will be freaked out, I told the firefighter. Perfect, he replied. No one anticipated the water would rise as fast and as ferociously as it did. When they pulled up, they screamed, we have to get you out now. We have to do it. So they threw what they could into a garbage bag and they got out and they were rescued. These her two children with Down syndrome are put onto a flatbed truck, and then they're watching as their pig Penny was being rescued by these fire workers. And this was a huge, big, pot-bellied pig who was none too excited when they tried to get the pig off the front porch. It was squealing a bit. And they kind of put like a little flotation device under the pig's like chest region so its front paws were on it.
Paws?
Well, I don't.
What is
legs?
hooves?
Well, that's the bottom.
Oh, yeah. So what would that be? Are they pig paws? I don't think they are pig paws, are they?
Their legs?
The legs? Yeah, let's go. I think, yeah.
All right, the pig legs, the front legs were over this little flotation device, and the pig was squealing like crazy, but then when it got on this little floaty, and they had the two firemen on each side of the pig,
yeah.
It was smooth sailing.
Oh, it was.
They just brought Penny the pig, and then they hoisted her up onto the flatbed of this truck where the family was rescued,
yeah.
And I got to tell you, I'm watching this, and everyone was so calm.
Mm-hmm.
Even Penny the pig got really calm, and then this sure. three-legged dog got rescued, and
wow,
it was just pretty amazing. Yeah. And Lisa Livingston Eicher posted this video. You can find it on the internet, and she was just excited about everyone coming to help them. She said, "The kids and I sat in the only spot safe from the rain in front of a gas station, and we waited. The attendant came out and brought us all sandwiches and ices.
Oh.
A sweet man insisted I take $20 to buy something for the kids, and a homeless couple brought us blankets, wanting nothing in return. Countless people stopped to check on us and offer help."
That's very nice.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, sure.
And then on the other side of the coin, you have people looting and robbing a GameStop. What has to be in your mind that you think with this tragedy going on,
can I cash in?
Yeah,
I always wonder that. I don't understand that. I mean, it's easy pickings because it's, you know, in such disarray, but that's terrible.
Well, we are safe and sound and at our good friend's house, and she just wanted to thank the people. So many of you have offered to help, even offered to open your homes to us, and we thank you. We are safe and sound.
I know Steve Dale is coming in on Friday, and I will not
be here. Is that
why
you're taking the day off?
It's not the only reason. I got other stuff going on. But please ask him, because my guess is animals must have this weird kind of sense that something has gone horribly wrong when they just see the world all topsy-turvy. And I guess their survival instincts must also have to react quickly, right?
Yeah, but I know you don't have pets. You do have a rabbit, though. And imagine if your house was flooded, the basement and the first part of the first floor was flooded.
Mm-hmm.
You would have to move this rabbit who's used to being in the girls' room.
Mm-hmm.
So even that is just disrupting what is, I mean, there's not a lot of excitement in a rabbit's life. So all of a sudden you have to move it. And
this rabbit has quite an active nightlife. He loves the club scene. Last week when they were packing, you know, Kylie was going to New York, just the mere fact that all of a sudden, you know, drawers were open and clothes were strewn about, that threw the rabbit off. And we weren't in any kind of danger. We weren't flooding. But just that made the rabbit running around like, this isn't supposed to be like this. What's going on? I need an explanation. So I can't imagine what they must go through when there is a catastrophe.
And I'm not slamming rabbits, okay? Because
no.
I had one named Nosy who lived to be about 12 years old.
Yeah.
But dogs really know it. Like if Jim's going out of town and he brings the suitcase down from the attic, Tiki already starts acting kind of weird because he knows that something is in disarray.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So I know that there are a lot of animals out there. And I mean,
you saw the story about some hawk. There was a vehicle and the hawk just landed, like came through the open window and sat in the passenger seat because he couldn't find, he or she, I don't know. I can't tell with hawks. Can you?
He
couldn't tell like if he'd be able to find a place to perch anymore.
So he just
so there
took
was some
the
vehicle and he went, well, I got to fly in the window and just sit there until things are normal again.
Was that for real? Because I heard there was
some. Was that a fake hawk story?
I don't know. I can't remember whose show I heard it on, but they played some audio. I think it was John Williams yesterday of a CNN reporter talking about the shark swimming down the street, which is a meme that's been going around for a while. And this, I believe it was CNN, said, you know, something of biblical proportions is happening because look, there's a shark swimming down the street, and it was a joke.
Yeah.
And he mentioned the hawk, too, so
oh,
I wonder
no.
if the hawk is for reals or if it's a joke.
I hope it's not. I believed it. Well, maybe it was Ken Harrelson. I don't know. I'll look. I'll do more research. I'll find out what it was, Wendy. I should have done more research.
All right. Well, good to know. And really, just watching some of the footage, I was sitting in my house last night making my kids look at this footage of this guy on the boat, this reporter on the boat, showed a stop sign. How tall is a stop sign? 5-6 feet?
It, yeah.
At least 5 feet.
Yeah.
It was the water was completely up to the bottom of the octagon.
Oh, no.
And so you look at these houses, and if they had a connected garage in the very front of their house, the water was up to like the roof of the garage, which means the basement's flooded, probably
right.
the first floor entirely.
And that's, you can't repair that, right? Like once you've gone through that much water damage,
well, you have to be able to repair it. What, do you just tear the house down?
I don't know. I don't know if structurally it's still sound enough to rebuild. I don't know enough about that.
When we talked to Ryan Burrow yesterday, too, and you asked a great question about the electricity and everything,
yeah.
and he said, no, that doesn't seem to be a problem. This reporter on the boat pointed out that there were two lights on somebody's deck that were on. And you're thinking, if a house is halfway underwater, isn't your electricity circuit breaker in the basement? Why didn't that go off? Why? How is there electricity?
I was under the impression, and it turns out I'm wrong, but I thought the electric company, if your house is in an area like that where there's heavy flooding, that they themselves, they disconnect the electricity so that there's not some sort of an electrical fire, I thought. But then you wouldn't be able to recharge your cell phone. You wouldn't be able to do anything to let people know you were there in the house. So I don't know how they make that decision.
But why isn't that? I just know that when our pre-permaseal, when our basement used to get 2 feet of water, which I feel terrible even complaining about now when these people had 20 feet of water,
yeah.
A lot of times something would be hissing and it was like, oh crap, the washer and dryer are still plugged in. Thankfully, they were up a little higher, so we got rubber gloves and unplugged it. But you'd think if a house is covered halfway, their circuit breakers and stuff are in the basement, why didn't that electricity short out?
Right. I don't know the answer.
And I know you'd want the street lights to be on because I know that Hurricane Katrina, the electricity was wiped out, and to have to do these search and rescues in pitch black would be terrible.
Right.
So I'm glad the lights are on, but I'm confused about it.
But isn't there a backup generator to handle, like, the public lights? There's some sort of a backup system for those, right? You may not have one in your house unless you buy one.
I don't know. When our lights go, I mean, when there's storms and we lose electricity on the block, the whole block's dark.
Everything's out.
Yeah. Hi, Dave. Something that you may know that I don't.
You remember when Pee Wee Herman went to the Alamo? He said, there's no basement. They don't have basements in Texas.
Why don't they?
Because of the way the soil is.
Oh!
It's like that in New Orleans, too. There's not a lot of basements. Even in New Orleans, I don't know if you know this, at cemeteries, the bodies aren't buried down
right.
underground. They're at ground level.
And during the floods, the caskets were floating
yeah.
around, I know.
Yeah.
All right, I forgot Pee Wee Herman could teach us a little something. Thank you, Dave.
Exactly. Yep.
Well, you already knew that. You could learn something from Pee Wee Herman. You knew that.
Yeah, I know. I guess
right.
I did.
All right, we'll take a break, and then more show. It's Bill and Wendy WGN. We're at 312-981-7200. Can we take Bill's call? I'm very curious as to his situation.
Well, we were talking about Hurricane Harvey and all the devastation going on in Houston and the surrounding communities right now. I wondered, with all this water on the street, how there could still be electricity. And I think, Bill, you and I are the only ones worried about this.
Mm-hmm.
Listener Bill, you have a story?
Oh, yes, in 87, I lived in Wooddale. We had that 7 or 8 inch rainfall one day, and we flooded, and it was, you know, it was a raised ranch, so it was filled the basement up to the ceiling, and it was about, let's say, 4 feet deep surrounding our house, and the power was still on until it actually hit the brook.
You broke up at the end. Are you still there, Bill? It broke up at the end. What happened? The power was still on until when?
Yeah, the power was on until, like, the water actually hit the electrical panel. And then it kind of shorted out, and then came around in a boat, and they pulled the meter off the side of the house. So it was totally dead. There was no electricity at all.
Was it better for you to have electricity or not have electricity at that point?
Well, it was a losing battle. I'll never forget this weekend. I think it was a Sunday. That fire was just coming up the driveway, like at a snail's pace, but significant enough to where we just got everything upstairs that we thought we could save. My parents got the appropriate paperwork in a box, and we knew it was going to flood. And, you just kind of, you know, you stay out of the basement, you're going to get electrocuted. And, you know, we got important papers and photographs, and we were able to salvage the stuff that had some meaning. And we were able to, avoid any, hurting ourselves or anything. But one thing I'd like to stress, it was that was a pretty simple flood compared to what's going on in Houston.
Yeah.
And we were out of our house for 2 months. We lived in a Holiday Inn while our house got repaired.
So I'm just reaching out to everybody. If, you know, donate what you can, and probably money is the best thing. You know, we had a lot of people like trying to give us stuff, and it was just money just helps to help offset some of the repair bills that people are going
to
have.
And you have to get crews out there to just basically rip out your entire basement, all the drywall, everything that got wet. And then if there's mold that developed, that has to happen too. But houses can be repaired, correct?
Well, yes. I mean, ours was pretty sound. It was a concrete foundation. My dad had from his butt to it was more or less hose it down. The next it really settles in. It's stagnant water and mosquitoes, and it's not nice. And the best thing is to methodically go through it. You can't do it all in one day. You know, I saw my parents going through a lot of heartache, and they had insurance, but they still ended up spending $20,000-$30,000.
Bill, sorry for all that happening to your family. Thanks for sharing that. We really appreciate it.
Take care. Bye-bye.
And the thing is, like, if you look at all this water that's going up to the second floor of these houses that's just completely on the street, it's going to take a while for it to recede, so they can't even begin reparations.
Yeah.
They can't do anything.
Nothing.
So thousands of people affected by Hurricane Harvey urgently need your support. You can help the American Red Cross provide meals and shelter to these families. You can donate today to Hurricane Harvey. Here's what you can do, and WGN Radio and WGN TV have partnered with the American Red Cross to help these victims, and this is the easiest way to give just a mere $10 donation, which everyone can afford. You text Harvey, H-A-R-V-E-Y, to this number, 90999, and that will be an automatic $10 donation. And if you'd like to donate more to help in the relief efforts of the victims of Hurricane Harvey, you can just go to redcross.org.
Are you aware of the Best Buy story in Texas? Now, keep in mind, I'm a big fan of Best Buy.
I am too.
I don't know much about electronics, but anytime I need something, I go to Best Buy. They're very helpful.
Geek Squad helping you out over there?
The Geek Squad has been very nice to me. Social media lit up on Tuesday after a picture was posted by a reporter on Twitter, which appeared to show a Best Buy in Texas charging $42 for a case of Dasani water. The picture also showed a price for a case of Smart Water that was listed at $29, with a sign noting that there was a limited supply of the fresh water. Subsequent commenters accused the store in the Houston suburb of Cypress, Texas, of price gouging. A 24-pack of water like this usually runs somewhere between $15 and $20, not $29, and certainly not $42, so they were being accused of price gouging. In a statement, a Best Buy spokesperson told Business Insider the pricing was, and I quote here, a big mistake. The price was seen only on Friday and was due to an employee who mistakenly priced the entire case of water using the price of a single bottle and then multiplying it. I don't know if that's accurate, but that's their statement. Best Buy does not typically sell cases of water, the statement notes, and so the point of sale system had no price for the entire case. The Best Buy location had been closed after Friday due to the storm. As a company, we are focused on helping and not hurting the affected people. We're sorry, and it will not happen again, according to Best Buy.
Can I tell you something right now? If I had a business, if I managed a Best Buy, I would only hire my family members and people that I trusted. Because really, one rogue employee now is giving Best Buy a bad name.
Yeah.
And then this guy, have you heard about Mattress Mac and what he did to do to help?
No.
Houston furniture store owner is being praised after he decided to open his doors to those displaced by this Hurricane Harvey. Jim Mattress Mac, Mackinvale.
Is this your husband? Who
no.
is this?
No, he's Jimmy Mac, not Mattress Mac.
Oh, I thought he was Mattress Mac.
No,
sorry.
Only when he's sleeping. Jim Mattress Mac Mackinvale opened up two of his showrooms and just allowed people to come in, tens of thousands to shelter some of the tens of thousands of people whose homes are now underwater. So as they were just walking by, he, you know, come and sit a spell.
Sure.
You know, he invited people. There were pictures of his showroom and people are sitting on the sofa beds and sitting on the mattresses. But at some point, these people just needed a place to get in out of the rain.
Right. He was helping them.
Oh, I just feel so terrible looking at all this video of just,
I know.
It's one thing to get a little bit of damage in your house. Yesterday on the stream, we were talking about, you know, if you have to be evacuated, you have different important mementos that are in different areas of your house. And perhaps we should all get like a little memento box and get everything that means something to us in one space. So if something like this happens,
you're ready.
Boom, you go grab it.
You're ready. That's so true.
So sorry.
Is Best Buy where Joel Osteen is buying his holy water, Wendy? That's what I'm trying to figure out. Let's take a quick break. We'll find out what Steve Bertrand has on the Wintrust business lunch. That's coming up next. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.